This is Phil Ferrand, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It's been a good week. Got a lot of good things accomplished. I'm on this new project that we've been doing, and so I've been going to meetings and talking to people and gathering information, and that's going to continue for several more weeks here, and then there'll be some analysis and yada, yada, yada. Building stuff, and I had a few little side projects that I was finishing up on, and so yeah, it's been fun. I always like to be busy. I don't like to be so busy that I'm putting in, you know, heavy hours, because then you get tired and then you make mistakes and you do silly things. I'm not fond of doing silly things that confuse users and you know, make you stay up late at night trying to figure out what in the world is going on. But I like having sufficient time to build the product correctly, do the appropriate testing, deploy it, have it go in smoothly. That's what we like. And it's also been a good week because we're kind of settling down now from the Christmas vacation and New Year and all that kind of stuff. So getting back kind of in the swing of things now, and things are settling into a regular schedule. Had a nice breakfast with a friend on Friday, and one of his acquaintances was there as well, so I got a chance to meet her, and that was very lovely, and we had a chance to talk a little bit about this, that, and the other. And then I got together with my young couple on Saturday and got to see how much their kids had grown, and we talked about this, that, and the other. And then I got together with my friend for breakfast on Tuesday, and my friend for chat Wednesday evening, and my friend for breakfast this morning. So it's been an all-around good week. I always love it when I get together with my friends and we talk. Things are puttering along with Farforth Fables 2. It's really interesting, this whole writing process. It's just very interesting. My goal was to get a chapter finished a week, roughed in, I should say, which is about 9. In this book, the chapters are averaging out somewhere around 8 to 9 pages. And I think I'm going to hit that. I'm going to try to work on it a little bit tonight, but I know what I need to say at the end of this chapter, and so I just need to say it and be done with it. I had started down one path, and I thought, no, that's not quite what this book is about, so I'm going to back up and punt. But first chapter is almost done, and we just have about 25 more chapters to go. I think the last book was 28 chapters. So, you know, you average about 9 pages a piece across 28 chapters, you end up somewhere around, 250 some odd pages, which is the target, somewhere around 250 pages. So, should be good. It should be good. We're at this stage of it. Everything is sort of a fog. I know generally where I'm going and what the high points are I'm supposed to hit, but it's all those little details that make the writing fun that you discover along the way that is just amusing. Because it's that continual process. I was telling my buddy this morning, when we were talking about creativity, it's this continual process of first there was nothing and then there was something. And it harkens me back and reminds me back to that creative process that's recorded in Genesis, where there is nothing and then God speaks and there is something. And that's, when I'm writing, that's kind of what I feel like, that worlds are being birthed into existence, and that's fun. I read a I read an article once, and I was thinking about doing a podcast on it, but I don't think there's enough there. I may come back to it later, called The Box and the Keyhole, or The Keyhole and the Box. And his main discussion point was how people view fiction. And he said, the average populace views fiction like a keyhole, that you're peeking through this keyhole and seeing this play out. And if you look away from the keyhole, the play is still playing out. Hence, people will ask authors, well, what happened to the characters after the book finished? And he said, those of us in literary circles who know better would respond to that type of question, nothing happened. The book is over. It's not real. As soon as you finish the book, it's over. Because supposedly that was the more mature way to look at reading. Oh, rats. I have the back end of my car is hanging out into an intersection. I thought for sure I was going to have enough. I think I'm in far enough that we're okay. Anyways, so this guy was saying that if you view stories as being in through a keyhole, then of course the characters can go on and live their lives. But of course, everybody knows that in reality, it's not a keyhole. It is simply the imagination of the author. And when the book is done, that universe just evaporates because it's a box. It's just in the box and it's over. And I thought, wow, that's kind of a cynical way to look at things. I mean, technically it's true, but I as an author, I don't think about it that way. I think about it like this, you know, maybe I'll revisit this little universe at some place and find out what else is happening to these people. I mean, Farforth Fables is going to be a trilogy for Amanda, the Book of Z, XI. But I'm going to put a little spot in there where there's going to be just the quick introduction of a character. And I don't have that worked out yet, but I know there's going to be some kind of quick introduction to a character that he has his own book. The book of, I don't even know who he is at this point. And, you know, someday I might get back and finish that up and do a trilogy on him as well. And maybe there's another character and there's another trilogy. You know, and maybe it's Amanda and this guy. So, in my mind, those things are all just sitting out there, and I haven't actually found them yet. But they're out there in that little universe that I've created. Anyways, so it's fun. It's fun. The reason that Amanda is ending up a trilogy, I think I mentioned this at one of the earlier podcasts, is that I had read an article I think the guy was giving a sermon, or he wrote it as a sermon, something. And I found some of the things he said very intriguing. And it started me down a path where I started thinking about some of those things. And that eventually ended me up in a trilogy. For Amanda, as opposed to 5 or 6 books or 7 books or whatever. Because the first book fit so well in with the first step of this trilogy that I just thought, oh yeah, I've got to do this because this makes tremendous sense. And I forgot to turn down my phone. I'm getting a phone call. They will call back. Anyways, so I think I mentioned this before, but I don't know that I actually talked about it. And I will say right at the beginning that this interpretation of the temptation of Jesus and of freedom and of truth and of happiness I like a lot of the things about it, but it's not necessarily something that I fully ascribe to. It's a nice idea, and I like thinking about it. And I kind of thought about it enough that I just took it my own way with Amanda. So anyway, so here we go. So there was an article somewhere, I didn't write it down, called The Freedom of Faith, A Christmas Sermon. And this is by Simon Critchley, C-R-I-T-C-H-L-E-Y. Simon Critchley, if you want to look it up. And it was very interesting. And he was using a section of the Brothers Karamazov, I think it is, by Dostoevsky. It was interesting. I was talking to my buddy this morning, and he said, yeah, I think my wife's read that. It's like, whoa! Because I've read pieces of it, and I just go, wow! I would have to wade through this. Maybe someday I'll make it my goal in life to read The Brothers Karamazov. It is supposed, reputed to be the greatest novel ever written. So there you go. Anyways, inside that, there's this thing called The Grand Inquisitor. There is a poem that one brother tells to another called The Grand Inquisitor. And it's this little mini writing exercise, mini novella, mini whatever you want to call it, story within a story. And it's pretty interesting. And it images the temptation of Christ as told by a Spanish inquisitor in the 1200s or the 12th century or something. They've had a great day in the Inquisition. They've burned a bunch of heretics at the stake. Hundreds of heretics have been burned at the stake. It's been a great day. And in the midst of all this, Jesus comes walking through the crowd. And everybody immediately recognizes him. And such is the hold over the people that the Grand Inquisitor has that he walks up and has Jesus arrested, and no one says anything. So he has Jesus arrested, he has him thrown into prison, and then the Grand Inquisitor comes to talk to Jesus in prison, and the rest of the story within the story is just kind of that conversation. And in that conversation, the Grand Inquisitor accuses Jesus of failing, of offering something which is unattainable to humans, and that is true freedom. That the path, according to the Inquisitor, the path that Jesus has laid out for human beings to follow is simply impossible to follow, and that there were things that he should have done differently, and if he had truly, well, if he had truly loved humanity, he would have done it that way, but he's given them an impossible task, and so it has fallen to the Grand Inquisitor and those of his ilk to then help humanity out by giving them what they really want instead of the path that of freedom that has been laid out before them. And by this, I'm assuming this path of freedom that we're talking about really comes down to the Sermon on the Mount. When you read the Sermon on the Mount, certainly there are a lot of things in the Sermon on the Mount that give a person pause. Turn the other cheek, love your enemies, blessed are the peacemakers, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. Turning on the heat, it's a little cool in here. And the Grand Inquisitor examines the temptations of Christ from the aspect of proving how each of these temptations, by refusing them, Christ actually was taking away something humanity needed in order to follow him. For instance, when Jesus refused to turn the stones into bread, he was ensuring that he would walk out of the desert without any bread in his hand. And according to the Grand Inquisitor, that was a mistake, because if he had walked out with bread, people would follow him. Because if you give people bread, if you feed them, if you take care of their physical needs, they'll follow you. In addition, by refusing to be thrown from the temple, or by refusing to jump from the top of the temple to prove that God's angels would bear him up, he refused to put himself on display to demonstrate his power so that all could be impressed by the mystery of who he was, his supernatural abilities. He failed to put that on display, and if he had put that on display and continued to put that on display, as the people demanded, they would follow him. And finally, he did not take the authority that was offered to him by Satan. He refused to bow down to Satan. And had he done so, Satan would have given him authority and would have allowed him to rule over the nations, which is really what humanity wants, according to the Grand Inquisitor. Humanity wants to be ruled, they want to be taken care of, and they want to have a sense of mystery in their life, that there is something out there that is watching over them, and that everything's going to be okay. Okay, well, that's an interesting viewpoint. The Grand Inquisitor does go on to make the point about the Catholic Church, that since Jesus has neglected to do things, they have decided they're going to do these things. And in that, they have been more than happy to get in league with the devil. I mean, you know, it goes on from there. Because what humanity wants more than freedom is happiness, even if it is diabolical happiness. They want to be relieved, in essence, from the tyranny of free choice and living within all free choice and choosing the way of Christ demands. Okay, well, that's a pretty interesting idea. The outward focus on the temptations is a little bit different than I would have thought of, and in fact, the outward focus seems a little contrived to me, because these were the temptations of Jesus, not really the temptations for Jesus to just work like people wanted him to work. I don't know, maybe, but you know, that doesn't work so much for me, but it's an interesting idea and I like thinking about it. What it got me thinking was this discussion that this guy had in the article about freedom and happiness. And it got me thinking about the temptations again, and really the three aspects of those temptations, which are internal struggles that each of us face when we are dealing with this constant battle in our own hearts between freedom and happiness. And then I realized that the first book of Amanda and the Scullyberry Tree is really about convenience. I wrote it that way, and I intentionally wrote it that way because I thought the series was going to be about globalization and capitalism and free markets, and it still will be. I'll still be addressing those issues. But now I know where to go, because even though the first level is all about globalization and free trade and capitalism, the response internally of the villagers at the end of the book is to recognize that all that was bringing them convenience, and that convenience came with a cost. And they realized the cost in time to be able to turn the tide and push it back. but they recognize that with just a few changes, they may not have actually recognized the cost until it was too late of their this convenience. And I got to thinking about that first temptation. If you're the Son of God, turn these stones into bread. And there is a certain element of convenience there. You're fasting, you're hungry, it's right here, why don't we just do it, have done with it, and then we'll hoof it out and get some food someplace else. It's not only convenience, it's also comfort. It's also getting your needs satisfied on the schedule you choose, in the way you choose. It is the fulfillment of I want, which is a very powerful drive within us. And often when we are pushing to fulfill that drive of I want, it leads us away from freedom, perhaps into happiness, but it is a happiness with a cost that is extracted at some point. So as soon as I made that connection, then I was like, oh, okay. So what can we do with the other temptations? And then in the other temptations, I thought, okay, well, throwing yourself off the temple. Why would you throw yourself off the temple? And Satan says to Jesus, throw yourself off your temple, because doesn't it say that his angels will bear you up in their hands lest you dash your foot against a stone? And what I see there is this whole issue of certainty. We're giving all these promises. We are told that God is going to do certain things in our lives. And is the temptation really that it's not good enough for God to tell us that he's going to be and do certain things in our lives? We want the certainty of it. So we want to throw ourselves off the temple. I'm getting my mail, one moment. And of course, Jesus' response is, you shouldn't tempt the Lord your God. And I think what is entailed in that is that if you think you have this all figured out and you just push to make sure that God's going to behave in the way you want him to behave, he might find another way to behave that will get everything accomplished that he wants to get accomplished, except the thing you are looking for certainty about. And so you may find that the tyranny of having to be certain begins to rob you of your freedom. And that uncertainty, I'm backing into my garage, and that uncertainty, in fact, leads to freedom, because it leads to an embrace of the truth, whether it's proven or not. And I know that's going to drive some people crazy, because they're scientifically, empirically oriented, and they just want to run experiments and only believe the things that are verifiable in the lab. But that may not be the source of freedom. And then the last one, which is what... So the second book in Farforth Fables, book two, is going to be about this process of uncertainty. And then the final book is going to be about the process of control. Because Satan says to Jesus, if you just bow down to me, look, I will put you in charge of all of these kingdoms. And oftentimes we think, oh, if I just had 1,000 people working for me. Oh, if I just had 1,000,000 fans on Twitter that just hung on every word that I say, then I would be in control. Then I would be safe. Then I would have what I want. But in fact, it doesn't always work that way. Because the more people that you have looking at you, expecting things from you, the more pull there is on you in multiple directions. And what you think is control and authority ends up being a different kind of tyranny. A couple of weeks ago, I talked about the TED Talk with the supermodel. And she mentioned at the end of it that she's very insecure about how she looks. And the reason she's insecure about it, if something happens, she loses her job. But beyond all that, she's under a spotlight constantly. So even though she has all these people looking at her, and because they're looking at her and they want to look at her, she's able to go cash in on that and get paid large sums of money for walking or for jogging in place back and forth. Large sums of money. But that comes with a price. All those people that are flittering around her to make her look a certain way, to become a product so she can make large sums of money. The price is that everyone is looking at her. And if she slips up and she doesn't look right, then there's criticism, and there's venting, and there's a price to pay. And so that thing which we thought was going to give us authority, that thing that we thought was going to give us control, in fact, becomes tyranny, and it begins to rob us of our freedom. So, with all of that, that's intriguing enough for me that that's going to be kind of the underlying individual lessons that I'm going to be working through. Because right now, this is a great time to write this book, as I've mentioned before, because I am coming to grips with the uncertainty of this time of my life. And so it's really going to be good for me to write about the ego ideals that I create working with this uncertainty as a way of setting up some principles for myself to say, this is how you should react to that uncertainty. And I might talk about that a little more next week. I'll see. I might talk about that a little more because it's very interesting, you know, reading The Long Tail and all those kind of things. I was talking to some friends this week, reflecting on my life and how things have gone in my life up to this point. And it's very interesting. And I am grateful, and I am becoming more grateful all the time for what my life has held in the past, and what it holds currently, and what it will hold in the future. But maybe we'll talk about that more next week. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.